Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are moving to 101.1 FM, simulcasting with 90.7 FM, but we will be at 101.1 FM permanently very soon. I'd like to welcome now the good folks from Forest Guardians. Joining us by telephone is Nicole Rosmarino, Conservation Director, and right here in the cafe, Melissa Haley, who's a staff attorney at Forest Guardians, and Rosie Brandenburg, the Communications Director. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte, for having us on. We're delighted to be here.
It's great to have you, and we have Nicole with us as well.
Yes. Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you here. Forest Guardians does a lot of different work, and we've had you on a number of times over the years talking about little pieces of it. Right now we're going to talk about a bunch of different things, starting with the story of the Mexican gray wolf. Melissa, tell us about the near extinction of the Mexican gray wolf.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Mary Charlotte. The Mexican gray wolf is the smallest, rarest, and most genetically distinct of the gray wolf species. This animal, along with all gray wolves, really was targeted, unfortunately, by government-sponsored predator control in the 1800s and then into the 1900s. By the 1950s, those predator control efforts really had completely eradicated the Mexican wolf in particular, and in fact, none were able to be found in the United States.
Now, this is a Mexican gray wolf. Are they found in Mexico?
They are found in Mexico. The historic range was actually very vast, all throughout the Southwest and down as far as Mexico City. And it was actually from Mexico in 1980 that the last five remaining Mexican gray wolves were captured and became the kind of seed, if you will, for this captive breeding program that has been used to foster reintroduction in the United States.
Were they exterminated, therefore, in Mexico by the Mexican counterparts to our predator control people?
They were actually partners in that effort. It's interesting, though, the predecessor agency to today's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which, of course, is charged with endangered species protection and recovery, was the U.S. Biological Survey, whose main mission really was to poison and eradicate predators on behalf of livestock interests. So it was by the 1930s that the U.S. Biological Survey sent its agents down into Mexico and began its poisoning campaign there.
And so they were down to five Mexican gray wolves on the planet Earth.
That's correct.
What happened next?
Like I said, in 1980, these five wolves were salvaged, taken into captivity, and became the seed for the captive breeding program. These animals, thankfully, were listed in 1976 under the Endangered Species Act, so at that point, they became federally protected. In 1998 is when we actually saw wolves starting to be released on the ground in New Mexico and Arizona. 11 animals were released at that time, and they were all taken from this captive breeding program that had been begun with those five individuals.
When there's a captive breeding program like that, they're bred in captivity, obviously. Is it hard for them to readjust to the wild once they get into it and they haven't been raised in the wild?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fish and Wildlife Service, now that we're this far along in the program, really encourages wild-born wolves as much as possible. Try to foster the breeding of wolves in the wild and make sure that animals are reared in the wild. Of course, that isn't always possible, especially with such low numbers and aggressive management that's taking place. Many animals do come from captive breeding facilities, but it's important to realize that while some of these facilities are in zoos, they're also in other areas and are run by scientists who really know what they're doing, if you will, and take these precautions definitely into account when they are rearing wolves and getting them prepared. They do as much as they can to limit human interaction and try to create an environment, although it is false, that mimics the natural environment as much as possible. So we don't have problems when wolves hit the ground. We want them to be wild, healthy wolves that hit the ground running and are able to thrive.
And, of course, it's a good thing I'm not doing that because I would be patting the cute little puppies.
I would as well.
We're talking to Melissa Haley from Forest Guardians. Some of them were released into the wild. Obviously, they need to be released into a place where they're not going to be shot up by people who are trying to protect their livestock again. How was that accomplished, or was it accomplished?
I don't think it has been accomplished. it's important to realize, if I can give you a little bit of background information, that anytime you reintroduce a large carnivore to an area, there's always bound to be some sort of controversy from local interests on the ground. In reintroducing the Mexican gray wolf to the Southwest, unfortunately, the level of human intolerance that was met by this program has really been above the norm of what we see, even with wolf reintroduction in other parts of the country. So in order to kind of quell the fears or the concerns, if you will, from livestock interests, there was a new set of rules made on how to manage this species. Like I said, it is protected under the Endangered Species Act, but when you reintroduce a population, the law allows managers to kind of tinker with the rules a little bit, go for more flexible management. So when livestock depredations do occur, and they are inevitable to some extent, the government has the ability to move wolves around, even remove wolves if they get into too much trouble, and there are also compensation programs set up for ranchers.
Meaning, so, if a wolf eats one of their cows, they get a new cow, or they get the cow paid for.
Right. Of course, anytime that happens, they would have to show, and there would be a government investigation, that was a confirmed wolf kill. But if it is shown that it was confirmed, Defenders of Wildlife is another environmental advocacy group that has a compensation program set up that compensates ranchers. They've been doing this for years and have been very successful with this program in Yellowstone.
So where were these wolves released in the state of New Mexico or in the Southwest?
Back to your original question, sorry. Importantly, the way those rules, the flexible management rules, are written now, wolves cannot be released into New Mexico. The program was met with such intolerance, specifically from our state, that the only place that wolves can be released is into Arizona. And then they can, of course, migrate over into New Mexico if their natural patterns take them there. But the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area is what the whole area is called. It's about 44,000 acres. It's made up of the Gila National Forest in New Mexico. That's the largest portion of the recovery area. And then the Apache National Forest in Arizona, as well as certain areas of the White Mountain Apache Tribes land.
This is land that's set aside for wolf recovery. What happens on that land? I mean, you can't really have a wolf recovery area with a national park with trails on it with people tramping around and hiking. I mean, things have to be kept separate.
Sure. Wolves are very resilient animals, which is great for them. Unfortunately, so many things have been working against them. You know, when managers looked and said, where are we going to reintroduce wolves in the Southwest? We know they belong here. We're federally mandated to recover this species. It's important to realize that they chose the area they did because of its wild character. You know, this is the most endangered mammal in North America, and here it is in New Mexico in the Gila Wilderness, which is the very first wilderness. The Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area was chosen because of its wild character. So the habitat is there, and if left alone, wolves can really come back on their own. The problem is not so much that we have too many roads in those areas, because there is a lot of wilderness area in the wolf recovery area, which by definition should not have roads. The real problem is the fact that the landscape is riddled with livestock, and that livestock is really being poorly managed at the behest of the Forest Service. So when we have conflicts with cattle, because the cattle are not managed well, we get this culling of wolves, where, again, we're being thrown back, you know, into the 1800s and early 1900s, where we're having a management program that's really become one of predator control instead of species recovery, once again, on behalf of livestock interests.
Well, it gets into a question which is very important, which is grazing livestock on public land versus on private ranches.
Sure. It's very interesting, and a lot of people really aren't kind of aware of this dynamic about grazing on public lands, and through no fault of their own. This isn't a subject that's often brought up in the public discourse, and I appreciate that we're taking the time to talk about this today. There are several millions of acres that are devoted to public lands livestock grazing, And while a lot of these are on Bureau of Land Management lands, they're also in our forests. And, you know, at Forest Guardians, we're always looking out for the way our national forests are managed. And a lot of people don't realize that their recreation and that their clean water and that these species recovery efforts are really, in some sense, kind of made second-tier priorities on our national forests. And it shouldn't be that way. There are multiple use mandates on the national forest. You know, it's the Forest Service's job to balance competing interests. Unfortunately, that charge is a little flawed from the outset, in that when you have certain programs, there really isn't room to balance everything. You have to choose priorities. We do have an agency, though, that consistently chooses livestock grazing over other priorities, and we are working to change those policies because we would like to see, and many of our constituents would like to see, our public lands being put more towards the use of recreation, clean water, clean air, and wildlife habitat.
We're talking to Melissa Haley from Forest Guardians. Who are the people in charge of making those decisions, and to what extent do their decisions come from above, from, let's say, a sympathetic or unsympathetic White House where it comes to endangered species versus business interests?
Sure. Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service is the ultimate authority when it comes to any sort of endangered species management. Like I said, though, this is a controversial program, and what they've done is taken on five partner agencies, really, so that they could work collaboratively in managing this program. Those partners include the Game and Fish Departments from New Mexico and Arizona, the Forest Service, Wildlife Services, ironically, which is the federal government's predator control agency these days, and also the White Mountain Apache Tribe. So management decisions are shared amongst this group of six partner agencies, and together, collectively, they make decisions of how the wolf is managed. Certainly, this is a heavily politically influenced program, and really that's the bane of the program's existence right now, is that it is not being driven by science, but instead is being driven by politics. There are only a handful of public lands ranchers in the Gila, and there are even fewer of them who, you know, diametrically oppose the wolf program. Unfortunately, these handful of people have tremendous political clout due to their associations with National Cattlemen's Association, and unfortunately and disproportionately have the opportunity and have taken advantage of that opportunity to drive the management of endangered species, especially where this program is concerned.
Let's turn perhaps to Nicole Rosmarino for a moment and talk about the importance of the wolf in the ecosystem.
Well, I think that Melissa can do that as well. But one little correction I want to make, just a slight misstep. Melissa, was you said the Blue Range Wolf Recovery Area was 44,000 acres. It's larger than that, right?
In any case, however big it is,
I think it's an important correction because it's a very large area, and it was chosen because of its importance biologically, and that's why the wolf has been reinserted into that large landscape.
Nicole, you're absolutely right, and I apologize if I said 44,000. It's 4.4 million acres. Thank you for pointing that out.
You bet. And I think we have a tremendous opportunity by reinserting the wolf into that landscape to see the kind of trophic cascades from wolf presence.
What kind of cascades?
They're called trophic cascades.
So
You see ripple effects through the ecosystem, just as we've seen in Yellowstone. Maybe Melissa can speak to that?
Certainly. You know, when wolves were brought back to Yellowstone National Park and the surrounding areas and into central Idaho, scientists knew that the role of apex carnivores was a tremendous one that really would reshape an ecosystem. Even they, though, did not realize the types and the magnitude of effect that they would have. Just 2 years after wolves were brought back to Yellowstone, they started seeing regrowth of cottonwoods and willows that had been in the ecosystem originally but had since left, since the wildlife scheme changed.
As a result of the disappearance of wolves, there were fewer cottonwood trees?
Absolutely, and it gets to be more than that. 10 years after reintroduction, the cottonwoods and willows that came back then brought back beavers, and then beavers were there to make their beaver ponds, which provide habitat for a whole host of other species. And by the time it was all said and done, so many changes had happened that, like Nicole said, scientists had to come up with a new name for it, which is where we get the phrase trophic cascade.
How do wolves lead to cottonwoods?
There are a whole host of changes, from prey density changes, which shifts the densities of many other species. Remember, we're dealing with a web of life, not really a chain of life. Wolves do things, though, even like increase nutrients in the soil, because they will scavenge, or excuse me, they will take down elk or deer, and then those carcasses change the nutrients in the soil. The nitrogen levels went up. So it's really this intricate, this whole host of things that happened that are all interconnected that led to these developments in the ecosystem that were really just baffling almost.
And so these are things that scientists study once the wolves are reintroduced. Meanwhile, there's livestock there. What if the livestock weren't there, what would the wolves be eating? Whom would the wolves be eating?
In the Southwest, their preferred prey base is elk.
And do elk then get overly big populations when there aren't natural predators like wolves?
They certainly can, sure. You know, it's interesting. It's a misconception. We hear a lot from the ranchers that many hunting groups would be opposed, you know, to wolves coming back because they decimate the elk population. And we know from scientific study that that's absolutely not true. And many hunters, by and large, are in support of the wolf population because they bring in more ecotourism to an area and increase their client base by default. You know, this harkens back all the way to the days of Aldo Leopold and his Sand County Almanac, where he talked about, you know, the green fire dying out and the last native wolf on the mountain. And, you know, he said that he finally understood the mountain and that really, you know, the deer had nothing to fear from the wolf. It goes all that we've known these lessons forever. It's really, you know, the wolf is something that's been plagued from the beginning of time with, you know, mythology, fairy tales, grim tales, you know, and it's lore. And it unfortunately continues.
The negative part
exactly,
is the lore.
It continues to perpetuate to this day, unfortunately, even in the face of so much science that shows the exact opposite and how healthy ecosystems become when you really try to put them more in balance.
Let's talk about what's happening in Catron County, New Mexico.
Sure. Catron County has been vocally opposed, perhaps the most vocally opposed, to the reintroduction project since the inception. They are not interested in wolves being recovered in the Southwest. They would like this program to go away. They've made it very clear that that is the result they'd like, and they've really been outspoken in the media lately, espousing lots of rhetoric about the damage that wolves are causing to them psychologically, and have really, unfortunately, been turning this situation into one more of puffery than logic and science.
Are they crying wolf?
They may very well be. You know, certainly...
Now, what, I mean, sorry, I'm making a silly joke, but what are the objections that they have? This is a ranching community down in the south part of the state. What do they do there? What kind of actual encounters are they having with wolves?
They really aren't having many. In the papers and the magazines that you would read, you would think that, you know, wolves are sieging Catron County, when in fact we know there's only a handful of wolves on the ground. And this is a very rural area where people are dispersed. There have been no encounters of wolves threatening or attacking humans in Catron County or elsewhere. In fact, there's not one documented incident ever of a healthy wild Mexican gray wolf attacking a human as far back as we know. So these are really unrealistic fears. The things that Catron County is citing when they are demanding wolf removals are things such as wolves coming into areas that they would like to be using on public lands, and also wolves staring at people for too long. These are the incidents.
Well, that isn't very polite.
It's not polite, but it certainly isn't illegal.
So there was an ordinance passed in Catron County.
There was. This past February, there was an ordinance passed where The county really is trying to usurp federal authority and take the last word in wolf management out of the hands of the partner groups that are in charge of the program now. There has been a long kind of tug of war in Catron County between them and the federal government. What it really boils down to is they don't want anyone interfering with what they consider to be their cultural, traditional heritage, if you will. The problem with that is that they are doing business on public lands that belong to all of us. This notion that Catron County has that the Gila National Forest should be wildlife free, frankly, is completely baseless. And they're not really getting what they would like from all of the managers there. You know, we do have aggressive management because they've been leaning on them. We're seeing a lot of wolves die on a monthly basis. Wolves are being removed consistently on behalf of the ranchers in Catron County, yet they say it just isn't enough. What they want is for the program to get killed and the wolves to go away. They want to be left alone. That's what their ordinance is all about. The ordinance is about taking control from the federal government and managing wolves on their own. And for them, managing wolves is getting rid of wolves.
And this flies in the face of the Endangered Species Act, according to a lawsuit that you, the Forest Guardians, has filed.
It absolutely does. We filed a suit about a week ago along with a partner group of ours called Sinopu, which is the Ute word for wolves. Sinopu is based in Boulder, Colorado, and certainly has been in tune with wolf programs around the country for decades. We filed a suit basically seeking to have this ordinance invalidated and to keep Catron County officials from acting pursuant to its purported authority in the future. The Endangered Species Act is our federal charter, if you will, for endangered species management. And like I said earlier, we have a whole host of federal rules that have been provided pursuant to this particular program that tell us how we get to manage wolves in this area. They really set forth the rules of the game. And for Catron County to come in and say, well, we know you've got all these rules of the game, but we don't like the game. We want to change the game, and we feel like we have the right to decide how wolves are going to be managed on our public lands. And so here's our ordinance, and that gives us that authority. Not only does it fly in the face of the Endangered Species Act, frankly, that type of assertion of authority is somewhat laughable, considering the fact that the Constitution of the United States blatantly says that federal law is going to trump any state or local ordinance.
So this now goes to court. What are the long-term strategies that you are thinking about that would harmonize grazing, the needs of cattle ranchers, the needs of endangered species, the needs of the Mexican gray wolf, and the needs of the public who do pay with their hard-earned tax dollars for public land?
Sure. Well, this is really one piece of the larger puzzle that you're talking about, and certainly Catron County isn't the only problem. The wolf program is really feeling heat from three sides. We've got the federal managers and their partners who are engaged in aggressive management, the Forest Service in particular, who refuses to impose any sort of responsible animal husbandry practices on its own permittees so that we could better avoid these livestock conflicts. And then we've got this rogue county over here who's looking to even ratchet up wolf kills even more and really inflame the system that's broken already. So we're working to attack all three of those fronts. We're looking to not only, you know, have Catron County back down, we're looking to really rework and influence policies within the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service with regard to their grazing and species management. We do that through participation in the administrative process when they're making decisions. A good example of how we're going to be influencing public policy for fish and wildlife is with rigorous participation in their new formulation of the management rules. They realize that the program isn't working. They're going to reopen public access to how the wolves are going to be managed on the ground. Certainly the ranchers are going to be involved in that process. The environmental community is going to be heavily involved in that process as well. So that type of collaboration is there. Always lawsuits have their place. We are a litigious organization when we need to be. We certainly feel that this is one area where, you know, the managers need to be forced. They aren't voluntarily coming into compliance with the law. We want to see wolves succeed on the ground, so we are going to use lawsuits to really, you know, hold the line on the letter of the law. Other things that we're doing, though, for more long-term solutions, we've been advocating as an organization for grazing permit buyout for years. We are really trying to get legislation or administrative avenues passed that would allow willing buyers and willing sellers to come together on public lands so that we can retire some of these grazing permits. It's very
so a conservation organization or a group of individuals would say, we're pooling our money to buy a grazing permit from somebody who's now using that on public lands and then set that aside for restoration in perpetuity, in it for conservation forever so that cattle couldn't graze on it?
Yeah, we'd like to be able to do it in perpetuity, and right now the laws don't allow. It wouldn't necessarily be forest guardians who was buying a grazing privilege. The privileges to graze are attached to a base property, is the term, private land that people own, little inholdings on public land. So really there are certain ranches for sale, and attached with them is this privilege to graze on, you know, however many thousands of acres that are adjacent to that land. And it's interesting, several key allotments in the Gila are for sale right now, where a lot of these conflicts have occurred. So what we would like to do is really kind of be a broker between willing sellers, ranchers who are looking to get out of the business and do so in a profitable manner, and willing buyers who are conservation advocates who want to come in, buy the brace property, and then take that adjacent grazing privilege and wave it back to the Forest Service so that they could permanently take it out of the system.
Now, in order for that to happen, legislation would need to be passed, because you can't just do that right now.
We can't do that right now. Legislation would be ideal that would allow the Forest Service to do that. It's possible that there would be administrative avenues as well if we're dealing just with a place-based buyout, which is really what our goal is right now, is to focus buyout efforts on the Gila bioregion, which would contain the recovery area for wolves. If the Forest Service kind of changed its own internal policies and rules, they could do that administratively, it would allow them to take permits and pull them out of the system as well. You'd need legislation if you were looking for something statewide or certainly for a national policy that allowed permit buyout. But for place-based buyout, it may not take that much.
Let's turn for a moment to Nicole Rosmarino, who is joining us by telephone. We've talked for a moment in terms of ecosystems about what the positive things that happen when wolves are reintroduced into an area where they naturally were before. What happens when there is overgrazing in a dry landscape like New Mexico? What are the effects to the ecosystem?
Well, the most glaring effects generally are damage to riparian areas. Because cows did evolve in Europe and Asia in wetter, more lush conditions, cows gravitate towards riparian areas, so streams and stream sides, and do tremendous damage. And that takes a toll on native wildlife, as about 75% to 80% of the Southwest's plants and animals depend on, or I'm sorry, the animals in the Southwest, 75% to 80% of them depend on those riparian areas for some element of their breeding or feeding or resting needs. So it really takes a tremendous toll. There's also impacts on the uplands from conflicts with wolves to also conflicts with other keystone species such as prairie dogs and pocket gophers. So we see just tremendous devastation wrought by livestock grazing on our public lands. And then there's also all of the inputs necessary to sustain cows in a non-native environment, including growing alfalfa along the Rio Grande. Some 80% of the water taken from the Rio Grande for agriculture goes to growing alfalfa, with tremendous impacts to not only the Rio Grande silvery minnow, but the hundreds of wildlife species that depend on the Rio Grande for an artery of life. So grazing has done tremendous damage to biodiversity in the Southwest. Certainly litigation is a key part of the solution, sort of forcing the Forest Service in particular to take a look at these impacts before renewing grazing permits. But also, as Melissa was describing, important solutions for long-term resolution of this conflict, such as grazing permit buyouts.
This leads to another activity that Forest Guardians is involved with, namely habitat restoration. What is Forest Guardians doing, Nicole, to restore habitats? You know,
apart from the whole question of the wolves?
Well, it definitely does connect with the grazing issue, as you say, in that Forest Guardians bids on state land parcels that are generally that are being grazed by cattle on our state lands. And when we're successful, which we have been, in obtaining these state land leases, the first step is to kick off the cows. The second step is to remove the non-natives caused by or exacerbated by the presence of cows, such as salt cedar and Russian olive and Siberian elm, so to remove the non-natives and then plant native vegetation. We've planted tens of thousands of cottonwoods and willows and box elders and other native trees and shrubs on our state land leases. And one example of our restoration program can be seen along several miles of the Santa Fe River, also several miles of the Rio Puerco, which is near Cuba, New Mexico.
These types of restoration projects, in addition to everything else, have an effect, an intended effect, on fighting global warming.
Yes, I think that Rosie can speak to that better than me, but I think an important part of that whole program is really linking the need to address our carbon consumption by connecting that to ecological restoration. But Rosie, do you want to talk to that?
Sure. Yes, our restoration projects do sequester carbon, so the carbon dioxide that we all emit in using our cars to heat our houses and that we've been kind of spewing into the air for years and years and years is absorbed by trees. So as Nicole said, when we go out in these state land parcels that we lease and plant native vegetation such as cottonwoods and willows, those trees not only provide habitat for several native species such as beaver, southwest willow flycatcher, and native fishes and all sorts of species, they also sequester carbon out of the air and really over a long period of time we can see some beneficial effects from taking that carbon dioxide out of our atmosphere and housing it inside of these trees. A cottonwood tree is about approximately 20% carbon. So over the life of the tree, as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, we're really taking some of the negative effects out of our atmosphere.
There's another set of activities that Forest Guardians is involved with, namely fighting oil and gas development. And some of that in oil and gas development plan includes Santa Fe, Galisteo area? Is that right, Nicole?
Yeah, there is oil and gas, primarily oil activity in the Galisteo Basin, which is showing signs of escalating, which is very scary for those of us that enjoy the Galisteo Basin's beauty. And it shows that oil and gas is coming to town. So I'm hoping that the Santa Fe community sits up and takes more notice of the harms wrought by oil and gas extraction, from harms to wild lands, but also to wildlife, groundwater contamination, but also, importantly, the very process of extracting oil and gas causes increases in greenhouse gas emissions from gas compressors as one enormous source in the Farmington area to greenhouse gases.
So not only the gas and oil that we then burn to heat our houses and drive our cars and so on, but the actual process of extraction is very harmful in that respect?
Exactly. So that process of extracting emits greenhouse gases, and as you note, then they're used by us. We consume them and emit greenhouse gases. So we think that the switch to renewable energy has to happen sooner rather than later. And part of our efforts are not only to protect the surface and wildlife and water, but also to keep those fossil fuels locked up underground where they aren't hurting anybody.
When you look at areas in the state of New Mexico where there has been oil and gas development, eventually they get all the fossil fuels that are to be had underground in that area. The area is left. How is it left? Do the companies doing the extraction have the obligation to, and do they do restoration of the land itself?
There is really a pathetic history of reclamation, not only in New Mexico, but across the Southwest where major oil reserves are found. But the Bush administration is increasingly touting reclamation under programs such as Restore New Mexico and the Healthy Lands Initiative. But these are really just greenwashing and poor greenwashing at that, for the fact that while a small percentage of lands are being touted for restoration projects from oil and gas activities, we see tens of thousands of acres of our public land being leased every quarter by the Bureau of Land Management, leased over to oil and gas industrialization on our federal lands, and really lay in ruins when the oil and gas companies are done. We think the surest course to reclamation of our native ecosystems is to not disturb them in the first place. We live in an incredibly arid state where it is very difficult to restore lands once disturbed.
Rosie, when I was talking to you the other day, you were talking about how in certain parts of New Mexico, the pumps from drilling are so loud that neither people nor animals can hear the wind or hear each other.
That's correct. I believe it's in the Carlsbad field office area. One is 19 times more likely to hear a pump jack than the wind. And this not only has kind of an aesthetic gasp that gets you right away, but it really has effect on native wildlife down there, in that certain species of birds who are required to hear each other to breed and to have mating calls, we see real declines in their population.
Because they can't hear each other's sweet songs.
To mate because of the interference and the noise pollution caused by these pump jacks. So not only are we dealing with the decimation that's going on the ground, but actually the noise pollution once this industry comes in and sets up shop in these wild places.
Nicole, not to belabor the subject too much, but when a piece of land is devastated by extractive industries, are there efforts? Is it possible to restore them, or is it just like a dead moonscape?
It is possible, but it takes a lot of inputs, and it takes having commercially available seed. And this was one of the problems in our mind the Otero Mesa drilling plan ran into, and that the Bureau of Land Management made promises about reclamation of approximately 140 wells that were predicted would go in on Otero Mesa, an incredibly important biological hotspot, largely comprising Chihuahua and Tozer grasslands. One of the problems in that reclamation scheme is that they were going to disturb black gramma grasslands, and there isn't commercially available in significant quantities black gramma grass seed. So it was just going to be impossible even from the beginning. But it is possible, and there are a couple sites that the Bureau of Land Management touts in Carlsbad. We haven't seen any in Farmington. But again, we're talking well under 1%, probably on the order, much, much lower than 1%, even attempt this sort of full-scale restoration where you're actually restoring the native plant community that was destroyed in the first place. And then you have to go a step further and assess whether native wildlife is actually using those reclaimed areas. So the science is very preliminary. Our critique is that the Bureau of Land Management is certainly not going far enough and really is ignoring what scientists are telling us about the problems of reclamation in the arid Southwest. And that gets us to our solution, which is don't disturb those lands to begin with.
We're talking to forest guardians. Nicole Rosmarino, are there incentives or subsidies or any kind of programs either in place or in the imagination at this point that would divert oil and gas projects into, let's say, solar and wind projects?
Well, there are certainly incentives. I mean, one obvious one is that some of these leases are turned over to oil and gas companies. Again, leases on our federal lands, our Bureau of Land Management lands.
So it's kind of like grazing.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes on the order of $2 to $3 an acre, which is nothing. Then these companies make billions off of our public lands. But they also do have to repay into state and local coffers royalties from that oil and gas extraction. But I think that you're right that we need to shift a lot of that money or some of that money into incentives for solar and wind, because we simply cannot continue to depend on the fossil fuel industry, because it is literally destroying our planet, and you can't put a price on our planet. So, yes, there are incentives involved, and there are monetary issues involved. We'd like to look at the long view, which is we need to seriously circumscribe oil and gas extraction and consumption if we want to survive on this planet.
Let's turn to yet another area that Forest Guardians is involved with, namely listing endangered species. You have a new strategy for getting into the endangered species, for listing new endangered species.
We do. Over the past couple months, we have petitioned for the federal protection under the Endangered Species Act of 681 species. And to put this number in perspective, there are currently about twice that number listed across the U.S., 1,352. So we seek to increase by 50% the national list. And the basis for our petitions, we filed two separate petitions requesting these listings, was the NatureServe system, because that is the nation's catalog of the status of our native wildlife and plants. And so we chose a very conservative route. We petitioned only full species, and only those species that were critically imperiled or imperiled. So the ones, you know, at the very brink of extinction or extremely, extremely rare. And so we have filed those petitions requesting that the Fish and Wildlife Service look at them in terms of potential ESA listing. And the important part of this strategy, Mary Charlotte, is that we are putting the burden on the Fish and Wildlife Service to tell the nation why these critically imperiled species don't deserve Endangered Species Act listing. Over 80% of the endangered species in the Southwest aren't protected by the Endangered Species Act, and we believe that deserves an explanation.
Now, this is a different tack that is usually taken. Usually there's an application one species at a time. Is that right?
Yes, we do very in-depth analysis. Our petitions generally take 2 to 3 years to prepare on single species. An example is the Gunnison's prairie dog. And the way we developed that 100-plus page petition was to send open records requests to a variety of federal and state agencies to absorb and analyze the responses from those requests and to repackage it into a petition for listing of the Gunnison's prairie dog. So basically taking much of the government's own data and serving it right back up to them. And we think that this is foolish, because the Fish and Wildlife Service, well, I'm sorry, I'll take that back. We don't think it's foolish. We think it's important to make strong cases for Endangered Species Act protection. But the result we got was political sabotage. Julie McDonald, the former Interior official who resigned amidst scandal on May 1st, just about a week before a congressional hearing on political sabotage of the Endangered Species Act, she literally reversed course for the Gunnison's prairie dog. It was on track, heading towards Endangered Species Act protection, and within over a long weekend, she ordered and obtained a negative petition finding. It was on course for positive. She turned that ship around.
Why did she do that?
Because she was a member, a faithful member of the Bush administration. Even though they're now painting her as a rogue and anomaly, we think that she embodied perfectly the Bush administration's extreme hostility to our nation's environment and endangered species in particular. We think that political sabotage is rife in the Bush administration's Interior Department. We think the Fish and Wildlife Service's national director, Dale Hall, who used to be the Southwest director, needs to resign. We think he epitomizes political sabotage. Under his reign, scientists in the Albuquerque office of the Fish and Wildlife Service were bullied and were censored and were unable to do their job, which is to protect endangered species.
So what happened with the Gunnison prairie dog?
So we went to court, and the Fish and Wildlife Service recently settled with us, and they'll give us a new finding on February 1st of next year, which, as you know, is on the eve of Prairie Dog Day.
Prairie Dog Day. And what are some of the, I mean, you now have this petition that contains hundreds and hundreds of southwestern species that are either imperiled or, as you say, critically imperiled. What are some examples of those species, and how do they contribute to the health of the ecosystems in which not only they, but we live?
Well, there are just a tremendous, there's a tremendous variety of species represented in both our southwestern petition and also our Rocky Mountain Prairie Region petition. Some in the southwest include yuccas and oaks. We have spring snails, we have prickly pears, the Arizona striped whiptail, a reptile. So really a wide array of plants. There are invertebrates, including insects and those snails I mentioned, and invertebrate species. The emphasis in the Southwest was actually invertebrates because there's just a lot of species of invertebrate species that occur in very narrow ranges and could be impacted by land uses in general, but issues like groundwater contamination, et cetera. And because they're so narrowly distributed, even the slightest impact could take a real toll. So in terms of the impacts on the ecosystem that the species extinctions would cause, we don't know. And that's all the more reason why we should protect them. All of these species deserve a place on the legal arc that the Endangered Species Act provides. And we can look to history, to the folly of discounting the impact of extinction. I always look to the passenger pigeon because it was once so numerous and numbered in the billions. And its flocks of millions darkened our skies for days. And all of a sudden, it was gone. After just a couple short decades of intense persecution by American farmers, the passenger pigeon had vanished from our skies forever. On September 1st, 1914, the last passenger pigeon, Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. And just a few years ago, we discovered the impact of that extinction. Just a couple years ago, an article came out in Conservation Biology describing how the loss of the passenger pigeon had fundamentally transformed eastern hardwood forests because of the impact of those heavy colonies of pigeons would break branches and cause more sunlight to percolate through the canopy in those eastern hardwood forests and would cause sun-loving plants to flourish more. Now we have a totally different ecosystem. So it's really quite compelling that almost a century after the last passenger pigeon disappeared, we're just now figuring out what that cost us and what the impact will be. And so I think that we need to be very cautious in the loss, in contemplating the loss of any species, whether it's a spider, whether it's a prairie dog, whether it's a bald eagle, whatever shape or form, we really need to proceed with humility. And the Endangered Species Act gives us that humility. It tells us we can't pick and choose. We can't play God. If a species is endangered, it should be protected.
Nicole Rosmarino, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Rosie Brandenburger and Melissa Haley, all from Forest Guardians, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Mary
Charlotte.
Thank
you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at KSFR live, KSFR.org, that is. You can email me at radiocafe@KSFR.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The address of that website is SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.